You probably have a copy of this book in your library. So if not, why, maybe you should get a half a dozen before you leave. An even dozen. Okay. You have joined not an organization, but a family of faith. And I hope in this hour to add a little perspective to that statement and share with you a little of that heritage. As in any family, that means that you share your lives openly and enjoy one another. There may be times when you're at each other's throats, but please God, you will get out your Bible and get it squared away before it goes as far as Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel didn't have the Bible, as you know. I remember vividly the excitement that I felt in being invited into this family, and I remember what attracted me to it in the first place. I was a Christian, very solid in my assurance of salvation and my conviction that God wanted me to serve Him in some way. I was one of a group of young people in New Orleans who was trying to find out the best way to invest our lives for the Lord. And we were memorizing the Navigator verses, which we had got through Young Life. And a sailor came to town with a Bible under his arm. And instead of asking to see the sights, as they very often did, he asked where he could find a few guys for a Bible study. And I thought that was great. He was a navigator, the first one I ever saw in uniform. When he spoke the scriptures, his emphasis was simply on doing what it said. That was new to me, too. Now, I was well checked out on the doctrine of justification and even knew about the second coming, but I had never seen this simple approach to the Bible of unqualified day-to-day obedience. And this was very attractive to me. And then Dawson Trotman came to town to speak at an evangelistic rally we organized, and I realized that there was never man spake like this man. I was impressed by his attitude toward the Bible and in his faith regarding finances. This was impressive to me. And I thought, here's an outfit I could sign up with. So I did. I've never doubted for a moment that this is where God wanted me to be. Not that all days have been happy days. In fact, anyone that you see around the Navs who has been here a good length of time is a survivor. Right, Lyle? I can remember walking across the glen, muttering to myself something about having to make bricks without straw, and feeling very battered. But even in those times, I would not have dreamed of leaving, because this was the place. So we are a family, and there's an invisible kinship, a kindred spirit, that's a little mysterious. And other organizations see it, people in other organizations, and they can't figure us out. You probably heard it. Out there in the Christian world, someone may be with this organization for a while and that organization for a while, and then they go to something else. But the relationship in the NAS is more like a blood tie. It's you take your share of poverty at times and give your money away recklessly to everybody who needs it. You've done it. You know how that is. And you rejoice in the success of the other members, and you feel their sorrows as keenly as your own. You feel their oneness with you in your successes and in your trials. And you know they're praying for you, and you know that you can share your heart with them and they will understand. Is that right? You sometimes sit down with an open Bible and help them with their blind spots, and they help you with yours. You forgive, and you're forgiven by each other. This is all part of what fellowship is all about. And I think I just gave you this fellowship spoke of the wheel. But it's no accident that the Navigator Fellowship works this way, for it is centered in Jesus Christ and in the Word of God. This is a part of our heritage that we should treasure it, because as you know, it is rare. We don't want to compare ourselves with others, but there is a certain uniqueness in this fellowship, and I know you appreciate it. I want to give you a little thumbnail, maybe a fist size, chronological NAV history from 1933 to 1980, because some of you don't know the background. I have an outline, so don't think this is going to be a rambling thing. First, a sort of sweep of the NAV history, giving places and events, and then I want to talk a little bit about Dawson and Lila personally. And I'd like to trace the philosophical history of the Navigators, including how a specific calling developed and some of the special emphases and traditions. Now, I want to mention some of the trials, the hard things that have gone into building the heritage that is ours today. Then, if there's time, we can have some questions. But first, a brief sketch of the Navigators from 1933 to 1980. Dawson Trotman surrendered to Christ at the age of 20 while he was working in the lumber yard through memorizing scripture. He taught a Sunday school class of boys, which grew into Bible clubs with 225 boys in a little town where he lived. He attended seminary 1 year, and then Bible Institute 1 year, but the ministry he was doing seemed more important than preparing to do it. So, especially the Greek and the Hebrew. So that was that for school. He was in the ministry, and he didn't see any sense of keeping on preparing. So in 1931, he formed a group of his peers who adopted a set of disciplines in a marine-like tradition. He called them the Minutemen. In 1933, he looked up a sailor, Les Spencer, who accepted his challenge to be a Minuteman. Spencer studied the Bible with Dawson when his ship was in. That's in West Virginia. And brought other men to Dawson Lila's home or to meetings in a garage behind the filling station. You've seen that picture in the Doss book of the filling station where they first met. And Doss ran this filling station to help meet expenses of their living. I think gas was 19 cents a gallon. The original four men helped minister to the others in a succession of Nav homes and on the ship. And they called the work the Servicemen's Bible Club No. 2. And in spring of 1935, 2 years after Spencer appeared, Dawson counted 12 foundation men, what he called foundation men in servicemen's work, that's 2 years, with four growing Christians coming along. And men on four ships in Long Beach were moving ahead. That was a little gauge of how they were doing at that time. In summer 1935, a gospel team took a 12,000-mile trip around the U.S. to look up the parents of the servicemen, the families, and to speak in churches. And they had a quartet sing and give testimonies. And they were billed as the Servicemen's Bible Club Minutemen, this quartet. But somewhere on the trip, they became Navigators, and that has stayed ever since. And they adopted the motto, to know Christ and to make him known. And they took this, they described that navigation, everybody was navigating on the sea of life, and Christ was the captain of their ship, and the Holy Spirit was the compass, and the Bible was their chart and their almanac, and they had a lot of things, analogies worked out. So the Navigators seemed like a good name. They a little bit shorter than Servicemen's Bible Club Minutemen. And then the fleet was out much of the time in the late 30s. And so Dawson ministered to the men in long letters that he would write and following them up. And he force-fed them at weekend conferences and retreats when they came into port. He would just poke all the Bible into them that they could take. And Jim Downing was converted in 1935. And he became the leader when the fleet was out. And he took the gospel teams ashore and other ports and just kind of directed what went on out in the fleet. And many sailors took leave to attend these Life Triumphant in Christ conferences that they held every year in Long Beach. It was kind of a navigator family reunion. They'd all get there if they possibly could. Dawson started working with high school boys in the Dunamis clubs. Followed by girls named Martyrus. Dunamis, as you probably know, is Greek for power, and Martyrus means witnesses. So the Dunamis Martyrus clubs began to, they were not only high school, they were, the Martyrus especially included working girls and others. But he designed Bible study methods for them and gave them the disciplines that was scaled down from the Minutemen disciplines. He held summer boys' camps and used the servicemen as camp counselors. he added a boys' worker and a secretary to his staff in 1939 and opened up an office in Los Angeles, a small, tiny room where he could meet with people. And this, I haven't used this, so we'll see how it works. This is a good place to show this as any. Total full-time, here it is right there. Total full-time staff of the Navigators in 1933, two. Guess who? In 1973, 935. 1980, 1696. So we've grown number of staff. And you're helping that. Cost of the Navigators Worldwide Ministry. 1935, I figured from what Doss had written down on expenses for a month, and it looks like $850 it cost them to run the Navigators work in 1935. How's that? That's a generous estimate, too. It could have been $750. I don't know. 1952, $105,000 worldwide. 1973 and 4, $10 million and 2. 78, 79, $19.8 million. And the budgeted amount for this year's ministry is $24.3 million. So we've kind of increased there, too. Not that we are trying to, but that's what things cost. And then in the spring of 1940, Doss planned to get Dunamis and Martyrs into the high schools across the U.S. and prayed for God to send the workers that he could really spread this thing all over the country and really take it every place. This was years before Young Life, before Youth for Christ, before Campus Life. There were no youth movements on the high school campuses. There was nothing. So this was a pioneer idea and a pioneer work. And in the fall, he started a Dunamis Martyrs seminar in the home to train teams that were going to travel around the U.S. in the Dunamis work, for a team of four fellows, five girls, or two teams. They kept the girls and fellows clubs separate. Incidentally, this was probably the first Navigator training program, the Dunamis Martyrs Seminar, held in the home. But they didn't recognize it as that because they didn't call it Navigators. A Navigator in those days meant a serviceman. So these were civilians, and they didn't count. Also in the spring of 1940, Dawson visited the Navigators in Honolulu, where most of the fleet was based then. And he saw 40,000 Navy men and 30,000 Army men out there, and it just nearly killed him to see all that opportunity to minister and not be able to meet it. He tried to build a network of contact so that Navigators would be in touch with fellowship wherever they went. And they'd go into a port. Selected Christians in port cities to open their homes and asked them to open their homes to Navigators so that they'd have that fellowship when they were in port. And he started the Navigators log in 1940, mainly as an exchange of news and medium of challenge to the men, as well as news of the Dunamis clubs. Then, meanwhile, he was going ahead with plans to expand the Dunamis nationwide and invited a promising young fellow named Lauren Sanny to the work. He was invited for the high school club work. Lauren began Dunamis in 1940 and joined the staff in 1941, and he took responsibility for all the clubs and camps. That was his parish, the civilian clubs and camps. So spring 1941, Dawson made another trip around the U.S., mainly to promote Dunamis. And there was a Wheaton student named Billy Graham who was much challenged by his down-to-business message. And you've read about that in Doss, how you asked him what he got out of his quiet time. And he blah, 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 and he didn't quite know. But they became friends then, and they were friends until he died. June 1941, they launched the Army work. So that was a whole new segment, new pool of manpower. And they visited men in the camps up and down the coast and around the country. They could get to them a little bit easier than they could the ships. They mailed out Keith L. Brooks question and answer Bible studies. Keith L. Brooks in Los Angeles was the first one who started these question and answer Bible studies, and there was one called Young Believers Bible Work that went out by what seemed like the millions. and a Christian character course and practical Bible doctrine, practical Bible training course. Those three books went out and were great, great help to the men in the fleet and in the camps. Charles Fuller, the old-fashioned revival hour, which was on the radio about, 35 or 40 years, he just mentioned that servicemen could get help by writing to the navigators. Dropped that word on the radio, and 1,000 letters a week, 1,000 letters a month began coming in for help from the servicemen to the navigators. So it was an explosion around there. September 1941, Collier's magazine came out with a feature story on the navigators, and this Collier's magazine was like Life or Look or any of those other defunct magazines but it was very popular at the time. So that was a great stroke of national publicity. At the time, they thought it was terrible, just awful, tragic, because all Dawson could see that it would create more demand. And he had a special aversion to publicity. He would not let anything be said. I don't know exactly why, but he had this feeling against being known. In fact, he wanted the Lord to get the glory in everything, and so he did not want the name Navigators boosted, and he did not want his name boosted. He just did not want anybody to get the credit with the Lord. So he kind of disliked that. In December 1941, Pearl Harbor sunk the Navigator's mother ship, the West Virginia. That scattered the biggest pool of navigators to other ships throughout the Navy. There wasn't anybody on the ship when it sunk as far as the navigators were concerned. Some of our fellows were out there pulling guys off the ship and rescuing them, but the navigators themselves were not. I think one fellow that had slight contact with died in that. Then they that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word, Acts 8:4. They did that same thing from the West Virginia throughout the fleet. In 1942 to 45 was World War II. Hard to imagine a war that was not fought nightly on American television, but that was it. Censorship was very tight. Nobody knew what was happening. No letters. People just would come in from the war areas and they would tell their stories. But no one knew what was going on. But it was a time of rapid expansion for the navigators. Doss put men on the staff who were men of God, but with little navigator background, because they desperately needed help in handling this influx of needy people. Then they developed the B rations to help meet the need. B rations was later called Beginning with Christ. But it was a miracle invention, as it included the verses that were most often needed to help a new Christian and in his first days of new life. And I guess it grew out of frustration with not being able to help these people personally. They had to put down on paper something, but Doss really hated to have to commit anything to print because it would get scattered around and not handled right. And his whole conviction was that this needs to be administered by a person, not a piece of paper. And that was, of course, always his conviction, that a man needed to be the vehicle of follow-up, but he had to, and it became a real boon to so many thousands and thousands of people. A lot of them were given wrong, but yet it's like seed sown. Some fell on good ground, and it was a great help. During those days, the NAS were sort of a spiritual Red Cross, giving first aid to what seemed like the whole world. Doss was frustrated because of the lack of disciple makers. They just weren't there. Just a few, handful. And the NAV work that year also started among nurses in San Francisco, and that spread through nurses and service women at different places where homes would be open for them. They could come. That goes back away. The women's work really goes back quite a ways, even though it hasn't grown as fast as it should have. In 1943, Doss prayed that God would try him. A friend who prayed with him said, "Why did you ask that?" And he said, I've got to, because he said that I'm facing some decisions that I have to make, and only if I know God is with me will I be able to make them right. And so we prayed for trial, and two trials came almost at once. His and Lila's fifth child was born mental invalid, and that was devastating. And then a navigator in the Pacific circulated a letter of accusation against Das that influenced a lot of men and caused many heartaches. And it was a terrible time. He was just crushed for months because of this, and because he loved these men, and to see division in the group that had been so close was just tragic. But the result was that his spirit was mellowed, and he feels that that was God's purpose in it. The period from 1946 to 48 was a time of retooling in the Navigators. After the war, men were discharged from the military, and the big effort was to steer them into the right schools and link them up with the right mission boards and churches where they could serve as laborers. Doss invited a very few, to come on the staff. But the main thrust was to get these men out to where they could serve God, either on the mission field, in the pastorate, or whatever God led, in business. And so he was very eager to see that everyone went forward to according to the plan of God for them. Financial support declined rapidly, sharply. After the war, these men who had been sending in part of their allowances to help keep the NAV work going, they were out of the service and didn't have that income, so the financial support dropped way down. And NAV homes in Jacksonville, Florida, and Oakland, California were sold, and the money used for operating expenses, they wouldn't let us do that today, would they? Every once in a while, just as the bottom of the barrel was being scraped, why someone would send in a $500 check, it would pay all the bills and keep everybody in groceries for a good while. But tent-making ideas were tried. As Paul made tents in Ephesus, they tried radio repair shop and a sign service and these other things that would make a little money to support the work, but it was obviously not God's plan because it just didn't seem to work. It was fun while it lasted. But through this shortage, God was signaling a change of financial policy that meant that the NAS would make financial needs known in a limited way to constituents and people, friends of the work. And much against Dawson's desires, but he had to admit that this was the way God was leading. And so in December 1948, the first direct mail financial appeal, hand-lettered, was sent to a carefully screened mailing list of those touched by the NAV ministry. It stated that the challenge of reaching out to the world to fulfill Christ's Great Commission and said we needed men and money to do this. So he was calling on them to furnish the money and pray for the men. So spring 1948, Dawson had urged, he was urged by many of the missionaries to make a trip overseas. So in spring he made this trip around the world, majoring on the Orient, and found a great demand for NAV emphases and follow-up and spiritual reproduction. These things were greatly needed on these mission fields, especially particularly in China, India, China, where the missionaries knew their time was running out. In fact, the communists were right on their heels right then, and they realized that if they left, everything was going to collapse. So they realized that they had to have, or should have all these years, have invested in Chinese disciples who could become disciple makers. The regular thing then was for a Chinese young person who came up to look promising to be sent off to Bible school, and when he was through, come back and pastor a little flock. And but who else could imitate him? They couldn't all be pastors, and so the flock was fed, and that was it. So Doss tried to impart this vision of multiplication, and he found a great need for it. And the result was that Roy Robertson was the first NAV missionary who went to China to launch the topical memory system and to train Timothy's. And he worked 22 months in Shanghai, very quietly, not holding big meetings, but just working with a few men. And he ended up in that time training 7 men and getting the topical memory system in Chinese distributed all over China through various points, distribution points. So they found out it would work. Then in 1949 to 53, it was a period of overseas expansion, going with the Grand Crusades, those two things. Robertson was in Shanghai, and then he was moved to Taiwan when it was the last minute the communists chased him out, or they felt it was time to go. And he went to Taiwan, and he started something there, and then in Japan, in 1951, he started something there. And Das made a second trip to Europe in 1949, and sent NAV representatives in 1950 to France and Germany and England. Can you hear me back there? Okay. Then Billy Graham took over Northwestern Schools as the president of Northwestern Schools due to a deathbed promise to the president who died, William Riley. And so he saw to it that Navigator courses were included in the curriculum of Northwestern Schools in Minneapolis. And European Bible Institute was started by a missionary, an ex-chaplain named Bob Evans. And he wanted Navigator courses in the European Bible Institute, which is now part of Greater Europe Mission, with whom you may be familiar. And the Minneapolis area did yield a number of NAV staff members, among them Doug Sparks, who went to Taiwan in 1951, and Leroy Imes, whom you may have heard of, and has been in the U.S. ministry. And Jody Baker came from that school. Another missionary to Japan was supplied, not by Minneapolis, but by the U.S. Marines, was Bob Boardman. And he went out about that time. So there was a pilot collegiate ministry called UCLA Project. Good name, isn't it? It was held at UCLA. It was launched by Lawrence Sanney in 1950. Sanney had directed the area work in Seattle since 1944, and then the Bay Area of California. And then in 1948, he had moved to headquarters as vice president. And he was in charge while Dawson was on this long world trip and worked into being in charge there. And he started this, pioneered this collegiate ministry. Some people don't realize that the college ministry goes back that far. But it was a good program. In 1952, Doss completed his own survey of the world, and including Latin America and Africa, and as well as Europe and Asia. He went every place. I don't know whether he didn't go to Australia, but that was about the only place. And then Europe and Asia, NAV men were already at work there, mainly under the flag of Youth for Christ or Orient Crusades or World Vision. Our fellows went out on their visas and to be a part of their work to help. This was the big goal, was to help these other missions that were getting started. And Doss's goal was to plant one or more navigators in 200 countries, every nation of the world, he said. And by planting a navigator, he didn't mean the flag. He just meant a man who was doing and teaching these principles, and by whatever means and through whatever medium. Then Billy Graham enlisted Doss to provide follow-up for the Crusades in early 1951. Doss took teams of the NAV staff to each Crusade, and he designed the counselor training and follow-up systems, which Sanney and Charlie Riggs continued to refine. Two effects of the Graham Crusading, at least, were as important to Doss as seeing the inquirers get the help that they needed. And one of those was that many thousands of Christians learned how to lead others to Christ. This was a big thrill to Dawson and to Lauren to see Christians who had never opened their mouth or opened their Bible to show another person how to be a Christian, to be able to sit down with them and lead them on into Christ. Doss called it bunting them in, you know, because they were already in the inquiry room. They'd already responded to the invitation. And just to be able to explain the way of salvation and pray with them and bring them in. It was a great thrill to see how people learned to do this. And as a result, it led many of them to continue. And the NAS staff people got valuable training through the crusade work. That was another benefit. Other benefits were the widespread publicity that the NAVs got by Billy Graham and the opportunity to discover and recruit one or two good men in each crusade, because they usually find one or two young fellows that they could keep in touch with and really develop as navigators. The Graham Council training and follow-up systems were widely copied by evangelists and churches, and the training of lay Christians for crusade counseling helped to spark the church-wide movement on stressing layman's ministry. Long through those years, it just grew steadily, the idea that lay people in the church are supposed to be doing the work. As Dawson used to tell them, that the shepherd doesn't have the lambs, the sheep have the lambs. And so this is this idea stemmed out of that, largely out of the Graham Crusade work. And manpower needs have snowballed for the navigators, because both for nav reps and personnel for other works, because everybody was asking the navigators, please give us some people, give us some men, give us some women, give us some workers. And so Doss held two seminars in 1953 at Star Ranch out here in Colorado Springs, and they brought nav men and women from around the U.S., and they said they came. The big saying was that they came with their hearts open and their bags packed. They didn't know where they were going, but they were ready to go. And there was a great spirit in those two seminars. People were just ready to be assigned anywhere they were asked to go. So some were loaned to works like Campus Crusade, which had just started. And in fact, Campus Crusade had almost totally staffed by NAVs in the beginning. And international students, which is now has its headquarters at Star Ranch, and some were sent out as NAV responsibility, NAV reps, there weren't too many terms then to designate what you were: intern, contact, NAV. You were a person, and you went. And some were sent to the U.S. and overseas, and Dawson would interview by the hour, you know, finding out what people wanted to do and so on, and then they'd have this big announcement thing at the end of the seminar telling where everybody was going. It was a very exciting time. The big event then of 1953 was the purchase of Glen Eyrie. It was a monumental venture of faith, as you've heard, one which stirred Doss to action, he said, more than anything in his entire life. It filled the urgent need for an international home for the navigators. Headquarters office, conference grounds, training center, even living quarters for the staff. And the down payment drive was a maxi miracle, bringing in $110,000 in cash in only 6 weeks. That little story is in the Glen Eyrie story booklet, but it's also in the Doss book. But the Glen Eyrie purchase united the staff in the U.S. and overseas as nothing before and gave them a sense of identity. First time Doss sent out this big urgent letter about Glen Eyrie all over the world, he wondered why there was no particular response. And he sent out another letter. He said, listen, I mean business. And turned out that the people overseas had got the letter and read it and thought, well, that was nice. But they were busy in their own things, and they had all kinds of things going on, and so it just didn't do anything. But he mobilized through that, through Glen Eyrie, he mobilized the whole world, navigators, to really pitch in and get going. And so it turned out that, like, some of our missionaries in Japan gave their whole month allowances to buy Glen Eyrie and just trusted God to feed them during that month. And that it became a big family affair. It gave us a sense of identity. It gathered together our people in the areas who were mainly involved in Youth for Christ, Campus Crusade, and InterVarsity, and so on, to focus on doing our thing, working under the NAV banner for the first time. Glen Eyrie brought too many potential staff and ministry contacts in close touch with the NAV leadership, because there was a place now to bring them. There was something you could say, this here, right here, is the navigators. Before that, they were here, there, and the other place, and all kind of infiltrated into other works. So getting Glen Eyrie was Dawson's crowning achievement of faith, second only to his training of Lorne Sanney and the men with him in leadership. Just 2 years after the Glen began its ministry, God took Dawson home following a boating accident at Scroon Lake, New York, as you know. Time magazine quoted Billy Graham saying that he lived to save others. And Graham conducted his funeral in this room. It was a victorious celebration. I can remember Lila and the others standing back there smiling and greeting the people as they went out, and the funeral directors were shaking their heads. They thought, is this a party or a funeral? You know, it was a great celebration. And it was what Billy called Dawson's coronation. And there wasn't any reason to be sad because it was a victory. The memorial service downtown was held to overflow crowds, and Billy preached there, and several found Christ at the memorial service. So it was a great time. For 10 years, 1954 to 64, Glen Eyrie was the NAV training program. Although Maranatha started in 1957 and the summer training summer task force in Washington, D.C., I think, in 1958, yet apart from that, this was the training program. And the fact there was a first training program was held in Los Angeles in 1949. It was 6 weeks with Doss in charge, but that was it was quite a long time before. So Glen Eyrie trained in 5 areas: on the job, in living unit, in classes, we had training classes, man-to-man, and in-town ministry. There was lots of training classes. In those days, you'd be working over in the office, you'd be typing away on your typewriter, you'd come over here to lead a training class, teach a training class. I taught classes in writing, and different. We had church history, we had everything you could imagine, just training classes. And you go back over to the office, and you come back over to play the piano for a conference meeting, because the conferences were going on at the same time as training program. Everybody did everything. And on Wednesday afternoon, we dug dandelions. And it was quite a thing. It was all kind of mixed up. And the efficiency was fairly low because nobody did any one thing for very long at a time. They'd all come over. The very first, when they moved in, everybody would come over at night and clean one of the rooms in the castle. And after their day's work, and then they clean another room the next night and so on until the whole place got shaped up. This training program at Glen Eyrie set the pattern for all the summer training programs, the work-live-study idea, and used younger people in training responsibilities. It focused on short-term goals in a life, but Glen training discontinued when it was crowded out by increasing demands on the Glen. As things grew bigger, they couldn't keep that up. And the staff and leadership, due to growth of the work, only last 3 or 4 years has the Glen returned to the training emphasis, and they now have a good training program here that is year-round. And as well, we have a different region brings a training program for the summer that helps. But, I mean, the regular year-round training program here is going very well. This summer, it's the Midwest, I believe. It's coming. Last summer, we had the Canadians. We had 45 Canadians down for the summer, and we had a very great time with them. In 1964, we had 250 enrolled in 6 programs around the country. NAV summer training has grown dramatically in the number of trainees and the number and kinds of programs, both in the U.S. and overseas. Now there's, you know, people go sign up to go overseas, or training program in the Middle East or Eastern Europe, and it's a great exchange, a cultural exchange, as well as training. Doss's style of leadership, the first 23 years of the NAS, was that of a pioneer, a strong, dominant personality, stream of new ideas, had his hand in many things at once, including a number of other works. And that meant that his hand was in many things at once. The whole crew, the whole gang, was in it with him. Because wherever he, whatever he got into, he took everybody with him. And he managed the entire work out of his hip pocket. He influenced every staff member personally. And he set the tone for the work as a man of faith and vision. During his time, there was strong centralized leadership with everyone reporting to him. Then Lauren worked with Doss 15 years. He became president at the age of 35. And God's unquestionable choice and sovereign timing, just when the NAV work must change, as it was well beyond the hip pocket stage. Lauren's gifts and style of leadership fit the second stage perfectly. He immediately worked at forming a team, at decentralizing and delegating, yet keeping the worldwide team close and unified. He constantly works at clarifying and maintaining the objective and using each man's gifts to the best advantage for the whole. He's an encourager. He's a pace setter. He's an inspirer, a coach. And he's become a genuine father figure to many around the world. They all look forward to when Lauren comes to town because they think, now I can really tell him what's going on. And he'll listen. In 1956, Doug Sparks was appointed to assist SANI at headquarters as overseas coordinator. We had men then in 14 countries. In 1961, our first overseas policy conference decided to fly the Navigator flag rather than enter countries under other organizations, and that was a kind of a turning point where they decided we'll be navigators around the world, we won't be parts of other organizations. So this is when that took place. The U.S. Areas Ministry took on a little bit longer to organize. It was more of it. In 1951, the NAVs had only three area directors, area reps, in the U.S., plus contacts in many places, and had to use many inexperienced men. 1955 had seven full-fledged areas. You people that have been through even a part of a training center thing have had a lot more training than the people who went were sent out to take over an area. Doss just said, go and do it. You know. But 1955, they had seven full-fledged areas with auxiliary homes, what they call auxiliary homes concept, added satellites to the area homes, where self-supporting couples ministered under the area man supervision. In 1957, a policy statement declared the U.S. areas to be recruiting and training centers. That's interesting, that they were recruiting and training centers. That's what the areas were to do. And in 1960, Leroy Imes took over as U.S. Areas Coordinator. And in 1962, he was Areas Director, with all the reps reporting to him instead of to SANI. So this was the first time that that decentralization took place. And the areas held fall conferences for evangelism, and they held spring conferences for consolidation of the troops. And they had one-day conferences, which began in 1959, and they multiplied. By 1962, they were having one-day conferences every place. Seven of the 16 areas open at the end of 1961 were later closed, and that shows a continual search for more productive areas and pools of manpower. They were experimenting, they were searching, they were moving, and some people complained that they just didn't get time to put roots down in one place till they got transferred. Now, that won't be funny to you. Because you've moved around quite a bit already. But now, I mean, since that time, there's been more of a drive to let a person stay in an area for a number of years and build on the foundation that they have established. But then they were searching and experimenting and trying new places. And they had less manpower to use, so they had to use everybody in the best possible place. Early in 1962, Lauren SANI took special time to seek God's direction for the future. He was given promises at that time from Isaiah 54, 2 and 3. And those he's been using those ever since. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch forth. Let them stretch forth the curtains of the habitations. And then he began to plan systematic yearly growth in the U.S. areas and overseas. At that time, they began to set percentages of target growth in the areas and overseas. They then had 29 reps, area reps in the U.S. and 20 overseas. So that was a 1962 kind of a milestone. You see where the growth took place there. 1967, Directors Conference, the stated intention was to develop worldwide NAV work for worldwide impact and let the U.S. Area Ministry set the U.S. Area Ministry prime objective of producing representatives and money for the worldwide work. This was the direction that they decided to go then. At the 1967, they said they developed the worldwide work for worldwide impact and set the U.S. Area Ministry the prime objective of producing representatives and money for the worldwide work. They also made the first attempt to evaluate progress in each country in terms of disciples and disciple makers. Since that time, there's been a continuous reorganizing and continuous planning as the Navigator world has evolved into regions and divisions and zones. And because multiplication does indeed work, our planning teams must step lively to provide a framework for all of our new people to fit into. It works, and so it's like the old woman with the shoe. She has to keep figuring out places to put them. Such is the 99 wonderful people here this week. We now have four divisions, the U.S., Europe, Middle East, and Africa, Pacific areas, and Latin America, and you'll be hearing, and Canada is a separate entity. Donald McGilchrist and some of the others will be telling you about more about that, about how we're divided up. Perhaps the greatest achievement of the last 3 years has been the careful construction by Lawrence Sanney and with input from the staff around the world of the fundamentals of the Navigator Ministry called the FOM. This is a monumental thing, and it will be you'll be using it for years to come. During the 70s, 13 other countries joined the USA in sending out one or more reps as a missionary. Australia, Britain, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Korea, Lebanon, Malaysia, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Singapore, and Sweden. And 14 of our 34 country leaders now are non-American. You don't know what that means, because unless you know what other missions have to face, and for God to have given us 14 non-American country leaders who are directing the work, and including the Americans who are working there, that is a real step forward. Roy Robertson once said that Doss's manner was hard, but his decisions were soft. And that Lauren's manner is soft, but his decisions are hard. And Lauren says, that's changing now. He says, I'm quoting Lauren, people say I am a benevolent dictator, but I object to being called benevolent. End of quote. So you can tell him I said that. Well, that's a sweep or a synthetic view of the Navigator history to date. Now I'd like to put in a personal note or two about Dawson and Lila, these two whom God used to start the whole thing, these two you saw on the slide. Dawson was 26 and Lila was 18 when they were married. He met her when she was 13 and waited for her to grow up. She did. They were married during the Depression and trusted God for provision of food, clothing, and shelter. When Les Spencer and the first Navy men met in that first garage to study the Bible, Dawson and Lila lived in a one-room cabin in a motor court with a two-burner hot plate to cook on. There was a little excerpt from I'd like to read here that tells about that. Dawson wrote in his journal, "We moved today," this is June 24, 1933, "we moved today to Lomita. Under the guiding hand of God, dear buddy and I moved, knowing that God is leading. I oftentimes thank God he has kept us on the move in view of future labor that we might be ready. From all indications, God is going to do something soon. I really believe some outstanding events with reference to his work will take place soon." And you know how average young couple that's married now that they like to have a place that they can settle down. Well, Doss says he's glad God kept him on the move. And I know from talking to Lila that she was right in there with him. And keeping on the move for the sake of the gospel, because they knew that that was going to further the ministry. The sailors urged them to move to an apartment in San Pedro, and they helped pay the rent. Lila wrote in her diary at that place, "As yet, we had not moved in, but we had several here for dinner." And then she wrote, "The first meeting of the fellows in their new home, in their new home." Isn't that good? And 4 months later, they moved to a home in Long Beach where there more men could come. Many times, the food for dinner would come in from somewhere into the back door while the sailors were coming in the front. And this was continuous. She could tell you more about that. After the heavy traffic and the sailors nearly killed them off, they moved to a larger home, but farther away from the beach, where fewer men would come and more could be accomplished in their lives. 5 years after their marriage, they moved into a bungalow in Long Beach, which they purchased with a down payment by a Navy officer. 3 years later, they moved to Los Angeles, where in addition to 4 children, they had the Dunamis Martyrs Seminar living with them. In 1943, the 6 Trotmans and 8 workers moved into 509, the picture you've probably all seen in the DOS book, the picture of the mansion that was built about the same time the castle was built by someone whom God appointed. And the Fuller Foundation bought 509 for the Navigators to use and rented it to the Navigators until they could buy it at the same price. I think the price was $16,700, something like that. So while it may have looked like they were living high on the hog, they were living high on the mountain of faith. Really, that's the way it's always been. But I thought that just a review of the homes they lived in and the way they freely shared everything with others would demonstrate the spirit of Christ, and that those of us privileged to live with them saw close up a home where Christ was truly the head and where love reigned. A home where there was always a lot of fun, sometimes a few tears, plenty of work to do. And you need to get this book, as I said, and read it, because there's many underlying principles in his life that are brought out I haven't majored in principles here in this presentation because this is supposed to be history. But don't read that book unless you intend to be really challenged down to your shoes. You'll find some good things about Lauren and Lucy Sandy in it, too. They were part of that group that moved in to 509 with the Trotmans. Now, we'll just have a short section on... we're just coming close here. We'll have a short section on the philosophical history of the Navigators. That was a kind of a chrono look and the people and places. 1931... Doss knew his commission was to work with young men. The next year, Doss prayed, "Lord, soon bring us into touch with a band of young men, rugged soldiers of the cross, with an eye single to thy glory." Around 1957, the objective of the navigators is to help fulfill the Great Commission by recruiting, building, and sending laborers. This is the first time that word laborers came into play. In 1961, the aim was redone, or objective was redone again. The objective of the Navigators is to contribute to the fulfillment of the Great Commission by producing reproducers and assisting others to produce reproducers in the countries where we decide to operate. A little bit more specific, but you're getting the picture there. Stays the same, different words. 66. The objective of the Navigators is to help fulfill the Great Commission by multiplying laborers. Can you see that as a light good? Okay. Then, 1968, the objective of the Navigators is to help fulfill the Great Commission by multiplying disciples. Okay? Same thing, multiplying. Can't get away from that. 76. The aim of the navigator is to help fulfill Christ's great commission by multiplying functioning disciples by means of disciple makers and disciple making ministries. Now, if you can't remember all that, you can remember that it says about the same thing that all the way through. Then, here we are, 1980. And of course, the primary aim of the navigator is to multiply laborers in every nation, thus helping to fulfill Christ's great commission. Now that's a little more succinct. And of course, this is through evangelizing, establishing, and equipping. You evangelize, results in converts. Establishing produces disciples. And equipping turns out laborers. So it might be a good idea to tattoo this on your arm or have a t-shirt printed. Because you're going to be seeing it a lot these next few years. And it would be good to just have it close to refer to. Okay. Probably the first clear-cut philosophical stroke of genius on Doss's part was the invention of the wheel. Now, you've heard the wheel was invented by the Chinese or somebody in the many centuries before Christ, but it wasn't. It was invented by Dawson Trotman about 1930 AD. Here's the old wheel. Christian in action. He, as you probably heard, got the idea, turned the idea of a three-legged stool into this wheel because he didn't like to live a Christian life sitting down. And this was a Christian in action. Christ is the center. Can you see that small picture? Okay, Christ is the center. Word, the foundational spoke, prayer, opposite, two spokes of intake, the two spokes of outlet, witnessing, and living the life. He called that living the life because he didn't know what else to call it. Then about 10 years later, it evolved into this Christian living the life. They pushed the living the life into the rim and put obedience in, which was one word description of what he was talking about all the time. And it's Christ in the center, still. Then, about 1968, obedience was pushed out to the rim, and fellowship became a spoke. So, please don't think up any more spokes for the wheel, because the rim's getting kind of full. The obedient Christian in action. Prayer, the word, witnessing, fellowship. This wasn't just a neat illustration, but it was an instrument for measuring and evaluation. And I didn't know that when I first saw it. Both in one's own life and in a ministry with another person. Someone comes to you with a spiritual headache, you sit down and check over the elements of the wheel and with them, and you'll probably find the problem by finding what's missing, which of the spokes, or maybe the hub, is missing in his life. So the wheel is a diagnostic tool. Then, a second tool that's very helpful and basic is a diagram of the hand. The Doss book tells how that was developed. It was probably one of Dawson's breakfast table inspirations. But the way this works is to grasp, the word is grasped by a balance, intake through reading, hearing, memory and study, and the thumb, meditation, combines with each and with all to grasp the word. A very clever analogy. And it's been used greatly, and you can use it, again, with yourself and with others to show. Am I in the road here? Sorry. To show what the need is to balance up one's intake. Then When Doss visited Honolulu navigators late in World War II, in 1945, he saw Bible classes proliferating all over the island, and nearly a complete absence of investing in individuals, man-to-man, training Timothys, and, as he began to call it, producing reproducers. And he had been practicing this through the years, but it crystallized for him, and he began to preach it everywhere he went, producing reproducers. Here's one of his illustrations. He hand-lettered, and I'll try to get out of your way this time. He shows here how he reached Sani. He trained Sani as his Timothy. Sani trained Riggs as his Timothy, but Sani, in the meantime, invested in all these guys below him there, below his name, as well. But he trained one man as his main Timothy. Now, Riggs over here worked with many of those men represented by squares underneath his name, but his main investment was in George Clark. And Clark worked with a few, but his main investment was in George Bostrom. And then Bostrom had one or two others, but his main thrust was with Lehrer. And Lehrer reached Rose. So this showed, this he was able to illustrate how you could have a wide ministry as well as invest in one man very thoroughly. Okay. If you glance at your T-shirt, you'll see that the word multiply is still in the Navigator Aim. Okay, in 1948, on his first world trip, Doss was spending time with the Lord on one evening on the roof of a hotel in Paris and looking up the stars. And so here was the sky, the way he saw it. Yeah, okay. And he was reviewing the Navigator calling. And praying about what we should be doing or should not be doing. And since it was dark, he hung the points of his outline on the Big Dipper. And here's the way it came out. There's the Big Dipper. Got that? Okay. And he, so he made the wheel. He made this star the wheel. Here's what we were teaching. That was the main pivotal thing of what navigators were teaching at the time. Then he took the word spoke of the wheel and dropped down here and made that evangelism. We'll put the hand. Evangelism. No, the word amplified into the. Then he thought, well, outreach, in order to make a scoop on this dipper, evangelism. This star better be evangelism. So he made that evangelism. Then he thought, what makes your cup hold water is follow-up. So this star became follow-up. Then that was a complete, sort of a complete cycle. And he thought, well, what other things are important? Well, the thing that gives you leverage in a person's life is pace setting, being an example. Okay? So he put that on there, part of the handle. Then you reach out further, other works. And then farthest of all, out on the tip, had to be world vision. So that was his dipper. And he came home. It was a logical way to explain it. And he was thrilled with the idea that it all fit into the dipper. During the 40s and 50s, there was a real great stress on other works, giving best people away to help other organizations get started and keep going. The Graham Crusade started with several of our people, Campus Crusade, and the international students and others. And then in the 60s and 70s, we kind of consolidated and brought more people into the Navigators proper and not aggressively building on other works. But now we're beginning to move out more and helping the churches with a 2-7 program and things like that. And in each of the last 2 years from our ministries, 100 people have gone to other works. So to seminary and other organizations and missions, over 200 in the last 2 years. So that's exciting. And that's this star right here that Dawson saw on the rooftop. So to kind of summarize some of what I'm calling the Navigator traditions, well, look at this list. These are purposely not listed in order, of any kind, because but are all the things I believe do and should continue to characterize us individually and collectively. Notice that it says things we believe in and practice. Now, I know that for all of us, the practice is far from perfect. But the Navigators are the first people I ever saw who held it up as an ideal and a possibility to believe and practice, and that belief and practice should go together. So let's keep working on it. The first, Christ preeminent, John 15:5. I am the vine, you the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do zero. Okay, the word is the next. We've gone through this in the wheel. These are things that characterize the Navigators. The word, 2 Timothy 3:16, is one key verse for that. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for our doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. You know that long before this, that that's a characteristic. Prayer, John 15:7. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you will and it shall be done unto you. Evangelism, 1. As I say, these aren't in any specific order. Matthew 4:19. And he said unto them, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. Can you all see over this? Okay. Then here's our good old follow-up. Dawson Trotman put follow-up into the consciousness of the kingdom of God worldwide, and that is an established fact. 1 Thessalonians 2:8, so being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to impart unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear unto us. Is one good verse on follow-up, and another one is when Jesus told Peter, feed my sheep. All right. Obedience. Romans 12:1 and John 14:21. He that hath my commandments and keepeth them, he that loveth me, and he that loveth me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him. Obedience includes application of the word, which we strongly stress, and includes the integrity of life that will hold up wherever you see it. Then pace setting, or necessity of example, that is strongly linked with obedience, but it's strongly mentioned, stressed in the Navs. Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you. Philippians 4:9 is the key verse on, or a key verse on pace setting or necessity of example. Serving others. And Philippians 2:3-4 is probably the key verse on that. Let nothing be done through strife, vainglory, competition, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than himself. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. It's that one. World vision, Acts 1:8, Matthew 28:19-20. You know those verses. The world vision, keeping away from a parochial viewpoint, seeing the world even as you're working with an individual, seeing the world through that person, seeing the world and keeping a broad world vision no matter where you are or what you're doing. Importance of the individual. I like Luke 19:5 on that. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide at thy house. There was one individual he came looking for in that crowd, and he was hiding, but he found him. The importance of the individual. This has always been a Nav strong point. This communicates, we can communicate this to people, that they are important, even if they're just one person. Excellence. A verse I like on that is Daniel 6:3-4, a passage. And this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him. Now, I know that may not mean a spirit of excellence, but I like to think it did. The king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion or fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither there was any error or fault found in him. Now, he was doing his work in the kingdom, which wasn't Bible study, and it wasn't his ministry. It was his secular work. He was doing it so perfectly that nobody could find fault with it. Now, if that isn't excellence, I don't know what is. And see how it is linked with faithfulness. For as much as he was faithful, so a part of faithfulness is doing it well, doing it thoroughly, and in an excellent manner. Jesus, it was said of him that he had done all things well. So I like that for excellence. Hospitality. Okay, we're just coming on the fine with our time. Hospitality, when Doss and Lila claimed for their first home, Isaiah 60:11. Therefore thy gates shall be open continually. They shall not be shut day nor night, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles, and that their kings may be brought. Isn't that beautiful? Their gates should not be open, but should be open day or night. Open continually. And that's the way it's been, and I think that's the way it is in a navigator home. Hospitality. Distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. It's Romans 12:13. Family spirit. Love. This is typical of the Navs, wherever you find them. Jesus said, by this shall all men know that ye are navigators, if ye have love one to another. Doesn't say that quite, but I think that's what it means. Faith. The whole work was built on faith. Day-by-day faith, long-range faith, faith that got this place for us right here. For without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Hebrews 11:6. We have exhortation, so-called. Ministry of exhortation, this is included. And based on Hebrews 3:13, which you all know, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. It's not a personal thing. It's an outside influence of sin that deceives us. We must gang up against sin, gang up against evil in exhorting one another daily, helping to overcome. Wholeheartedness is another thing. Colossians 3:23. Whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. And 2 Chronicles 31:21 tells that in every work that he began in the service of the house of God and in the law and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered. That wholeheartedness is a typical navigator trait. Do you have too many? Okay, generosity. And you know 2 Corinthians 9:6-7. And he that soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly. Reap, sow and reap bountifully. Every man as he purposes in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And I've never seen any more cheerful givers than in the navigators. Cheerful and sacrificial. You've experienced that, and I have too, many times. I've seen both Doss and Lauren empty their wallets to give to a need, no matter what's a dentist or what it is, and just pull out all the money they have. And it's a humbling thing when it first happens to you, but then when you get a chance to do it for somebody else, why, you enjoy it. Finally, we have one more here. The home. The home is the keystone of the whole thing. Haggai 2:9 is a verse that Doss and Lila claimed later, for 509, that was what it was. Here it is. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. Isn't that a beautiful promise for the home? And they've claimed that, for their home at 509. The ministry of the home has been traditionally an understood factor, as well as maybe sometimes neglected. But the impact that can be had on each other's lives in a place like in the home, in the Navigator home, is immeasurable. There's one verse I want to look up, 2 Timothy 3:10, in connection with this ministry of the home. 2 Timothy 3:10, "But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience, persecutions, afflictions, which came unto me at Antioch," and so on. "But out of them all the Lord delivered me." Where can you know all those things about a person except you live with them? And that's the quickest, most effective way of really training disciples is in your home. That includes your children. So I hope you can claim 2 Timothy 3:10 for your home. It began by a matter of economic necessity, but it turned out to be a blessing of God and a regular windfall for ministry, the home. Finally, I'll just mention something that I think we have to be aware of. That is, a membership in this family, this organization, doesn't come cheap. The high price has been paid to bring you and me to the place where we are today. And Doss paid a price in prayer. He prayed many hours for you, though not by name, but he prayed for you. And things like that, he suffered things like that circular letter that defamed his character or his reputation, which he saw as a stroke of the enemy trying to divide the work and destroy the Navigators. He endured travel, which sounds glamorous, until it turns into months away from home, getting malaria on a missionary trip, and other strange bugs that made him so sick that in India they had to prop him up on the pulpit so he could speak, getting lacquer poisoning over in China, and having his body turn into 1,000 blisters. Well, things like that, prices that were paid, they go on and on. Lauren Sani has paid a price. For about 6 years, he was away from his family, many months out of the year, with the Billy Graham Crusades. And he was away when his youngest daughter was born. And you know, some of you, what that means. A young fellow came up from another state to see Lauren and said, "You don't notice me, you don't promote me, and I'm going off and start my own work." So Lauren has to take things like that. He absorbs them, and you never hear about them. But he takes to heart the problems and the difficulties of all the staff, and he doesn't have to, but it's not in his job description, but he does. And he has a sensitive heart and a big heart, and many sleepless nights he spent working on problems in the work, and praying over the people, the staff, praying for staff that never had a clue that he was concerned about them. Your leaders, your immediate leaders that you were trained by, have gone through quite a bit to get you where you are, and you will go through quite a bit to get others, to bring others along. So I thought you ought to know this. Some of these things, I don't know who would tell you if I didn't. But it costs plenty to belong to the Nav family. And we just think of, Jesus didn't promise us a rose garden, but he gave us something far better. So welcome to the family.